Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast version of the Talkie Bit from Sunday, September the 13th, 2020. The reason this is the podcast version is a little technical glitch. So the content is the same, but the vibe is a little different. And if you want to see the original, then the best way to do that is to check out our Table Facebook page where the original video from the live stream is hosted. Sometimes I feel like the big challenges going on around us these days coalesce into a kind of wad in my gut that feels like it's made out of something heavy and immutable. Like it's something in there that can't be broken down or processed and that doesn't feel like it can be made to go away. And that is not a nice feeling. And there's a powerful urge inside of me to do whatever will make it go away, even if that's just for a few moments. And I recognize that urge as a kind of complicated mix of natural and healthy and unhealthy. It's natural in the sense that it's self-preserving. It has some of its roots in my evolutionary reality in the sense that it is a response to being threatened. My lizard brain, that part of us as humans that responds instinctually to threats, is ready to fight it or to run away from it or to just stand there immobilized for a bit while I try to figure out what's going on. My executive brain, the part of us that houses our personal sober second thought, wants to say to the lizard, you know, just cool your jets for a while so I can think about this and make a good informed choice about what to do. And which part wins, frankly, can sometimes come down to things like how strong does the threat feel? If it's too strong, the lizard might get the upper hand. But if the corner office can win out, I might stand back and consider what's going on inside of me long enough to have some actual thoughts about it. My hope is that this particular exploration might help us to bring our higher faculties, our executive brain, including our spiritual selves, we could say, to bear on whatever makes us feel most anxious or afraid, whatever it is that contributes to that lump in our gut. That's partly why if you visit the online version of this, or if you are with us when we gather for the live stream, that's partly why we take time to just stop and breathe together at the beginning of those times. It's a way of embodying that act of making space for consideration. It's when we do that sort of thing, it gives our bodies a chance to slow down. And the lizard, so to speak, might not actually have a nap, but it might stop running around and yelling at the top of its lungs for a few moments. And those moments can help to make space for us to move in a different direction going forward from whatever that intersection is that we're at. It really is pretty incredible how much positive impact something as simple as conscious or mindful breathing can have on us. Really very, very worth making the space for in our lives. And we never need that more than when we're facing big challenges. And those can sometimes come from the least expected places. Sometimes it can feel like the most mundane combinations of circumstances stir up our sense of uncertainty or fear. It's the sort of things that can throw us off our stride that can feel disruptive. They don't have to be disasters of the cataclysmic sort. They can just be a disruption in ordinary things. I don't think I've ever been more aware of being surrounded by stressed out people at any point in this pandemic than I was this past week. And it wasn't because we were all being told to lock down again all of a sudden or something like that. It was because school was starting. Now, school starting, although it can be a big deal even under usual circumstances, isn't generally a high anxiety event in the wider culture. In fact, in my conversations over the years of parenting school-age kids, I talked to a lot of parents for whom back to school was a relief. Now, this maybe is the sort of thing we don't talk about very much, or you know, with just anyone, because it can sound really, it can sound really not very flattering. You know, it can sound like we really don't like our kids. But the parents that I'm thinking about that I talked with were, you know, they were great parents. They loved their kids. They cherished time with them. They really made it a priority, and they were relieved when they went back to school. And I think one of the reasons for that is it's summer, although it can be very lovely and it has holidays in it and all that good stuff, is also a disruption of those longer rhythms of the year. And back to school can feel like a return to those patterns, to those rhythms. So we can love our kids, we can love spending time with them and all of that, and still be really relieved when it's time for them to go back to school. But when our sense of confidence that even the most strenuous efforts of administrators, educators, and staff, and man, I know lots of these people, and they are working their butts off to make back to school work. But when our sense of confidence that no matter how hard the teams that run our schools work, school can't be made safe or effective or well-managed or predictable under the current circumstances, when that sort of a shift happens, all of a sudden this normal event of going back to school can become a really high stress event. The ordinary stressor of returning to school combined with the extraordinary circumstances of this particular return can turn something mundane into something that gets our primal fears riled up and contributes to that lump in our gut, that generalized sense of anxiety. I don't have any kids going back to school this fall. Taya is entering grade 11, but she's been homeschooled all along. So that aspect of our life and her life isn't where I've personally felt the disruption more keenly. For me, some ordinary events kind of came together this week, and they included back to school stress because I'm surrounded by it. But what really got me paying attention, what kind of really got at the core of me this week, was the combination I experienced on Wednesday morning when I heard the news about the fires in the refugee camps on Lesbos in Greece, and I couldn't buy some paint that I needed. It's a true story. One of these does not sound and is not like the other, but they came together in a kind of a curious way. So I'm in the middle of painting the exterior of our house, and I need more paint. I don't need just any old paint. Never mind that the color needs to match. It actually needs to be a very particular kind of paint that I've already begun to work with. And you can't get that paint anywhere right now. And that's because the company that makes it can't get cans to put it in. And they can't get cans because the manufacturers for cans were shut down in March and April during the lockdown, and they haven't been able to catch up. And one of the reasons for that is because there's trade tariffs on aluminum and so on and so forth. And so, anyway, short version, couldn't get paint. And while I'm talking to suppliers on the phone, thinking that this little paint thing is just my little anomaly, I should have chosen a different kind of paint to begin with, so on and so forth, I'm finding out that lumber yards are running out of lumber, and they're running out of other building supplies. And while I'm in the middle of that, already something that I've never experienced in my lifetime, the radio is telling me about the fires that destroyed the refugee camps in Greece and how there are now several thousand people sleeping in a ditch because they have nowhere to go, and the little that they did manage to salvage when they fled their homes as refugees has been destroyed. And somehow those things kind of came together. The painting of my house does not, under any circumstances, constitute an authentic crisis. If it feels that way, that means I've lost my perspective. And all I have to do to be reminded that that is the case is think for like 10 seconds about those people in Greece. Never mind stopping to think more particularly or more deeply about the fact that those camps that were destroyed were the homes of, 20,000 refugees, but that over 4,000 of those refugees are unattended children. Man, if the human in me didn't get it from the 20,000 people with no home, the parent in me should really get it from the 4,000 children with no home, no parents, no resources. Now, I would honestly rather be fussed about my paint supply problem, because it's one that I can mostly understand and because it operates at a considerable distance from my having things like shelter or food or clothing. So, it's much more manageable. I can't get paint. I can work with that. A few moments of reflection and my executive brain can tell my lizard to just shut up about that already, and it generally listens. But what do we do when we're trying to process things like a global pandemic or a global climate crisis or back to school or all of those at the same time? Well, listen, as a species, we're pretty amazing. We are remarkable beings. We're powerfully equipped to cope with a staggering range of challenges. But we have limits. And sometimes, challenges that feel like they're just too big to get our heads around or too traumatic to fit into our hearts, sometimes big challenges like that can take us to those limits. They can take us to the edges of what we can handle, and they feel like they just might push us over. And sometimes they do. Sometimes they do push us over. And then we have to try to deal with that in addition to the original crisis, which may very well still be ongoing. And that's hard. That is very, very hard. One of the ways we deal with that sort of combination is by reaching deep into our human capacities. We dig down into things like resilience and hope and determination and love and caring and faith and good habits and restorative practices. And we can also dig down into things like our mechanisms of self-preservation, our mechanisms for self-defense. I had a recent conversation with a friend whose kid has recently been in a relationship with someone that turned out to be a predator. And I'm happy to say that in this instance, their child is safe and progress is being made on setting boundaries on the behavior of the other party. One revealing part of that conversation was when this parent told me about how they realized in the midst of this struggle that they would actually be literally willing to die for their child, that they would do whatever it took to protect their child. And we ended up talking about how one of the implications of that experience is the realization that under different circumstances, that same passionate commitment could move us or someone like us to not only be willing to die for our child, but be willing to kill for our child. And we might think, there's a thing I would not do. Or maybe we can easily think of circumstances where we realized, yeah, that is something that I am capable of. As a species, we're this incredible mixed bag of lovely and awful. And for me, that's a compound word, awful. There's something awesome about those capacities and their potential, and not just in one direction, not just their potential for good, but their potential for harm as well, for full-on evil. But I chose awful as the contrasting word to lovely because I don't think it's helpful to start with a feeling of shame about our capacity for things like dying for or even killing for those we love. I think those capacities arrive with being human. They just are. They are something that is part of who we are as a species. It's what we do with those realities that makes all the difference. One of those mixed bag capacities that we tend to draw on when we're feeling overwhelmed is our capacity for indifference. This is an interesting human capacity to me. I mean, some would argue that this is one of the most dangerous capacities we possess. And you could define it fairly straightforwardly as not being interested in something or someone, not thinking about it or them, whatever the circumstance is or whoever the individual might be or the group. Now, we can't all be thinking about everyone or everything all the time. So how might a capacity like the capacity for indifference be powerful or dangerous? I mean, isn't it just necessary? Don't we just need this? Well, the crux of the answer to that question is that indifference is often how we respond to overwhelm or to a sense of powerlessness. We could think of indifference as fight, flight, and freeze all rolled up into one potent bundle. It's a way of keeping something at bay, running away, and doing nothing at all at the same time. Sort of a one-stop method for not going anywhere near whatever it is that's causing us to feel powerless. And feeling powerless is a pretty common response to big crises like global pandemics or global climate emergencies or even big combinations of ordinary crises. So far, that might mostly sound like bad news. This is not an unusual rhythm for a template-generated talky bit. I think it's important for us to have our heads up and our eyes open about the challenges that we're in the midst of, the challenges that we live with just by being human. I don't think switching our brains off is actually a good way to explore what we believe or to move forward in our lives, spiritual or otherwise. So I don't want to back away from that part. I also don't want to stop there because we want to keep on living. We want to live more deeply and more fully. So here's a question. if this is such a common response, if indifference is such a common response, and if it's so effective in keeping us from engaging with things that matter a great deal both to us personally and to all of our species, if it backs us away from things that we really need to engage with, what can we do? I think there's a clue in something that I ran into in my reading this past week, and this is from a college educator. And they are sort of responding to that question about if indifference keeps us from engaging with things that we need to engage with, what can we do? This is what they said. The kids, by which they mean they're college students, the kids facing this century of change may end up becoming the heroic generation. There will be great challenges and great opportunities for them. There may very well be a new form of culture that needs to be built, and they will be the ones building it. The point is, this time around, the process may very well begin not in the vast sphere of global politics, but in the most intimate domains of immediate experience. That last line, that's the crack where the light gets in. Not in the vast sphere of global politics, but in the most intimate domains of immediate experience. So here's a question. When we're faced with a sense of powerlessness, which we all experience routinely in varying degrees, often in the midst of ordinary experiences like sending our kids back to school, what might motivate us to engage rather than to detach? What might motivate us to care rather than to become indifferent? I think, if not the key, then at least a key, is to start at the place where we are. What the writer that I just quoted called the intimate domain of immediate experience. You might recall a slogan, this is still around, but it was perhaps more common in the earlier days of us kind of as a culture in this part of the world trying to generate a collective response to our growing awareness that climate change might be a problem. The phrase was and is, think global, act local. So I can remember encountering this first of all as sort of an encouragement to recycle or compost, you know, the kind of things that anyone can do. We could think global, act local as sort of describing the intimate domain of immediate experience. Act local. Act where you are in your experience. But then if we kind of wrap it up, so we add kind of the intimate part to the domain of immediate experience, in some ways, that phrase, the intimate domain of immediate experience, isn't just describing act local, it's describing act hyper local. There are lots of ways we could come at this, but let's consider a relational one for a moment. One of the reasons I think a relational lens for this is a good one to look through is because our relational lives seem to operate in that same deep part of our human experience as our fears. They seem to operate in that place where we feel things like love, where spirit thrives or shrivels. And one way to access that realm, which can be a little mysterious, a little hard to kind of get at just because we decided to. And one of the ways to access that realm where we love and are loved or fear those things or dig deep into those things and lean into them, one of the ways to access that realm is through the enduring genius of spiritual teachers. And the spiritual teacher that I'm most familiar with in terms of teachers whose teachings have endured for a long time is Jesus. And so I'm going to go there for a moment. I feel as though what I would call the genius of Jesus connects with all of this stuff that I've been talking about when he tells his followers, I've only got one commandment for you. And that commandment is that you love one another as I have loved you. Now, if you grew up in or around traditions in which Jesus is a central figure, you've probably heard this text immediately turn toward the idea of being willing to die for someone. We've sort of touched on that willingness earlier, and I hope kept it grounded by acknowledging that it comes from, in many ways, really the same place as being willing to kill for someone. Here's another lens we could read that through. whatever we might think of Jesus, and in an exploratory community like this, there's going to be a wide range of perspectives. The way that we have received the Jesus stories, they tell us about a Jewish rabbi that entered deeply into a very distressing story that they were surrounded by. It's easy to forget that the people group Jesus was from, Jesus' people, were the Jews, and that at the point in the story where we have the Jesus stories, that entire people group lived in the middle of the reality of being powerless and in daily danger of being wiped out. They were oppressed. They were oppressed militarily, culturally, religiously, materially, financially, economically, geographically. You can go on. In every way a people group could be oppressed, they were oppressed. The only reason they got to do what they wanted in terms of everyday things like work or education or religion or dress or language, all those cultural pieces, was because their military overlords said they could. The Romans had discovered that this sort of letting subjugated peoples continue to their cultural practices and religious practices, they discovered that this was sort of the lesser of the evils when it came to keeping people groups that they had conquered from rebelling. If we just let them have this, then, you know, they're not going to get together in secret and arm themselves and have a go at overthrowing us. So the Jewish people who are living under this model of military and other sorts of oppression, they know that what they are experiencing is not real freedom. They know that they really were, in the final event, trapped in circumstances about which they could do relatively little. And I don't think it's a big reach to see here some parallels to things like pandemics or to climate crisis or to torched refugee camps or uncertain back-to-school returns. I mean, pick a crisis that makes us feel powerless, and that the feeling inside of us as humans is akin to something that Jesus' people lived with all the time. So that's the environment in which we have those stories. And in that environment, Jesus offers this directive about how not to get stuck. And it's especially instructive when it's combined with his teaching about nonviolence, because between him saying, put away your swords, people, and I only have one commandment for you, love one another, we've got the core of a path forward that is brilliantly hyperlocal. Jesus didn't try to get out of those difficult circumstances, and he really pushed back on the folks that thought that violence was the answer. He entered as deeply as anyone into the hard parts of the story. We could say that he experienced in his body the reality of being powerless. I don't know how else you would describe being executed. In particular, you know, perhaps being executed on charges that were clearly fabricated. So that's a profoundly powerless experience. So assuming that we're talking about an actual historic person here, the draw toward indifference as a way of coping with the drive to either fight or to flee or to just kind of disappear into the wilderness somewhere to do nothing would have been just as acute for Jesus as it is for you and I. But the response, this response, love one another, takes us into the heart of something we can do. And we can start in what I've been calling our heart. We can start with the one another's closest to us. We can start in the realms where we already have proximity and relationship. That really is the most intimate domain of our personal experience. And we can start there by loving one another, not just when those we know agree with us or think like us or look like us or act like us or believe like us or have the same accent as us, or we could go on, but when they don't, when there's a gap. Is this a hard idea? Well, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I can absolutely say that in my experience, this is a hard idea. It's the kind of idea that can be very costly. It might even cost us everything we've got. But it's also a way to not get stuck in overwhelm because of the wider circumstances that surround us. It's a way to enter deeply, actively into the story we're already in, instead of putting up walls of indifference. It's a way to look at our circumstances, at the massive nature of some of those circumstances in the global sense, the massive nature of some of those circumstances in the I feel this so strongly in my heart, it feels like it's going to rend me, you know, the way we might feel about sending our kids back to school under complicated circumstances. In the heart of those kinds of circumstances, the question, when I am overwhelmed or stuck, who can I love, remains a way to not get trapped into indifference as our way of responding. No matter what happens, our choice to love one another is a choice that no one can take away. And not only no one, but no thing, no circumstance. We can choose to love one another. And that is one way to assail and to undermine the negative aspects of our capacity for indifference. Well, I feel like I've got lots to chew on from my own reflection about this. I'm going to leave it there and go see how I can do with this. And I want to cheer for you as you go and do the same. Peace, everybody. Thanks for listening. It's been good to be with you. We'll chat again. Bye for now.